here with Alain de Botton, who is most recently the author of Religion for Atheists. Alain, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Great to have you. Your books, since I have very little time, I'm going to do as quick as I can. Your books very often have this moment where you describe a very funny, yet sometimes socially awkward encounter where you attempt to impart some concept or some amazing idea in your head that you are excited about, and that the person who is receiving this intelligence often expresses some dismay. I think of, for example, your long speech at the Mojave Airport graveyard and the pleasures and sorrows of work, or your attempt to pitch yourself as a writer in flight to the British Airways head honcho, Willie Walsh. Obviously, I think, based off of this, you are aware that some of your excitement is being misperceived. So, in light of trying to consider a scenario along the lines of what you're preaching in Religion for Atheists, where you're trying to have certain concepts stick in other people's heads, and religion is more fraught, more sensitive than the norm, how do you get through to these people? I mean, how if you're aware of these things, I mean, you're probably going to have moments even more extreme than the two I've cited. So what of this predicament? How do you go ahead and convert these people over to your side?
I suppose when it comes to religion, you've got extremists on both sides of the debate. You've got religious believers who are very fervent in their belief and think that anything besides full conversion to their creed is not acceptable. And at the same time, you have very fierce atheists who think that any involvement with religion is, you know, evil and to be resisted. And I've tried to write a book that's somewhere in the middle of those two. It's a book that tries to say that as an atheist, you can nevertheless engage with aspects of religion, and indeed those aspects may be very enriching for your understanding of secular society. So it's a weird book because it really is fairly in the middle of something that most people would consider to be incompatible, which is atheism and religion. It's arguing that atheists should engage and can engage with aspects of religion. It can be shot at from both sides, but I also think there is a silent majority that is actually in sympathy with the approach I'm taking. But that is a silent majority. They don't have the pulpits.
But if the movers and shakers, such as the man at the graveyard, require $20 bills to advance things, I'm wondering how you can instill these ideas into a new belief system if everything is centered around commerce, centered around capitalism, centered around the need to get ahead, centered around some sort of unusual man asking to see the airplanes and so forth. I mean, you know, this I think is one of the interesting takeaways I get from your book. So how do you solve this?
Well, I think that the proposals that I make are aiming to get secular capitalist people in secular capitalist societies to rethink their positions on things. I'm arguing that there are certain things missing from modern society. Though we've been fantastically good at delivering material improvements and supplying material needs in the developed world, there are some other needs, which you might call spiritual, and I use that word without any supernatural implications, but spiritual or psychological needs have been left slightly unattended. I'm thinking here of things like our need for community, our need for a moral structure, our need for certain guidance through the challenges of life. These things have not been so well done by the secular world, and I'm arguing that one of the ways in which we can plug some of the gaps of the secular world is to look back at the lessons of religion. And my book is full of examples of concepts and practices and rituals that one might rescue or at least learn from as atheists in the secular world.
Well, there's one idea, the agape restaurant, where you have different types of people sitting at the same table, sharing their stories and so forth. But I'm wondering what safeguards you have in place for people who are shy or who are introverted. There's a new book by Susan Cain called Quiet that gets into the amount of social energy one has to exert if one is introverted or even ambiverted. And so this also, you know, leads me to ask, well, if I go into a situation and I'm asked to share my most intimate secrets with a stranger, I'm not certain if I would want to do that because maybe someone there might want to steal my identity or so forth. Mm. We would enter such a social arrangement with understandable suspicion. So, and if you're an introvert, you know, they may be very, very scared, or it may actually be a little intimidating to be asked to engage in this extroverted activity. So what of these kinds of problems here? What are your solutions? What are your workarounds?
I guess my starting point is that the modern world is not so good at community building, that there's a lot of loneliness because much of who we are doesn't get an expression in social life. And this is surprising because with Facebook and other social media, we were supposed to have cracked this. But I think people will still complain that in many areas, we don't have good communities, and religions are unparalleled at building communities. Now, how do religions build communities? One of the things they do is they gather people around a table every now and then and get them to break bread together and get them to talk. That's how early Christianity started. It started as a series of meals between the followers of Jesus who remembered his lessons and got together to eat. And as I say, you find this in all faiths, that somehow the stranger is invited to the table and is welcomed to the table, and the stranger is turned into a friend. It's a beautiful idea, a simple idea. And, you know, I couldn't help but contrast this with the modern world, where we're obsessed with eating, and newspapers and media are full of places to eat, and you know, the restaurant world is you know, high on the agenda. But what's never really spoken of is the meal as a source of a social engagement, as a source of discovery of another person. And that is really what interested me. And so with the example of religion in mind, one of the things I do in my book is to suggest how we might learn from the tradition of communal dining of religions. And and precisely set up meals between strangers. Now, of course, some of them may feel uncomfortable, and some people like to eat on their own, so it wouldn't be for everybody. But I think in many of us, there is a desire to shed the armor which we normally have to wear in daily life, and to eat with others, and to discover our shared and common humanity.
But what I'm saying is if an introvert who is very fond of, say, one-on-one exchanges as opposed to mass group exchanges, I mean, how does such a communal dining experience account for that? I mean, you know, they may very, like I said, they may feel very uncomfortable, maybe a lot of social energy. You're saying they should actually go ahead and ask very, you know, answer very deep questions about what they fear. And so how do you account for them?
Well, look, it's not for everyone. As I say, if someone wants a one-on-one meal, if someone's not interested in community, then it might not be for them.
Well, how do you get them involved in the community? If the ideal here is to get everybody on the same page,
it doesn't have to be everybody, but it has to be those among us who hunger for community, as many of us do.
But introverts do hunger for community. They just go about it in a different way.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't speak for them.
Okay. Early in the book, you bring up the Day of Atonement, the moment on the Hebrew calendar where Jews must identify all those who they have hurt or behaved unjustly towards. Now, those who are part of the Day of Atonement are inclined to forgive any offenders for annoying them or causing them grief. But it is an undeniable truth that very often when you apologize to someone in the secular world, well, they're not exactly going to have the same degree of understanding sometimes. In fact, your apology may aggravate the other person further. So I'm wondering, to get something along the lines of a Day of Atonement for sort of a secular or non-religious group, I'm wondering, does it take a specific secular rites? Is it a situation like, for example, in Australia, if you don't go and vote, 95% of the people turn out, because if you don't vote, then you'll actually get fined. So I'm wondering if a Day of Atonement along the lines of what you're talking about would require something like a government mandate for everybody to kind of just apologize to everybody. What of this sort of dilemma? Mm.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think what strikes me as a secular person is how intelligent religious communities are at realizing that community is a very nice thing in many ways, but it's also very challenging. And you find throughout the history of religion mechanisms to ease social tensions. And it struck me that the Jewish Day of Atonement was, is particularly clever and insightful in recognizing that what holds communities back is grudges, things that are undigested in the past. And what it encourages people to do is to both accept that another person may have an apology, have a grudge to bring up, but also that it behoves you not to drag out that grudge. So there's a kind of mutual responsibility on both sides not to drag out an argument and to move towards forgiveness. And the assumption, the underlying assumption, is that God is the only perfect being, and anyone else is going to be flawed. And so we have to forgive on the basis of our fragility and flawed natures. And I think that's a very beautiful idea. Look, the specifics of how an atheist might do this, can yet be worked out, but it's food for thought. You know, I think for me, what's interesting here is that the psychological mechanism of forgiveness based on a recognition of imperfection. And this is something that the modern world struggles with.
How do you reach, though, someone who is not inclined to forgive, or who may not in fact be on the same page? I mean, I'm all for you. I would love to see everybody forgive everybody for their sins or their errors or their slights and whatnot. But the fact is that a lot of people are just not going to. I mean, you know, so what does it take to really bring people around? Mm. Does it take constant promotion of idealism along the lines of what you're saying?
Well, I mean, in the Jewish Day of Atonement, what gets people motivated is a sense that it is normal to both forgive and to have a grudge that you need to bring up. Mm-hmm. That and I think that too often when people are not in the mood for discussing issues, for discussing grudges, it's because they feel that they're not going to get a proper hearing, that it might be embarrassing to do this, that dialogue with another is impossible. So it's a kind of pessimistic position. And sometimes we may need a bit of help. We may need a third person to come along, to mediators.
Voluntary mediators.
And that's, in a sense, what the role that God is playing in the Jewish community at that point. He is a mediator.
Yeah. So you, in addition to having a temple for atheism, we also need to get a mediator army of volunteers. Would this also kind of help to sort of spread further goodwill and bonhomie?
Yeah, I think you're focusing a little bit unfairly on the practical aspects of this. I'm really, I suppose, writing as a psychologist. I'm interested in the psychology of religion and the psychology of the dynamics that are being explored. So, you know, how exactly this might apply, how a secular person might absorb this into their life, is capable of many different interpretations.
But aren't pragmatics important when considering the psychological possibilities of what human beings are capable of?
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, we don't have to decide today what that would be.
I'm just picking your brain here.
Sure, of course.
In the architecture section, you bring up this need to feel small. You point out that this is a painful daily reality of the human playground, but then you write, "But to be made to feel small by something mighty, noble, accomplished, and intelligent is to have wisdom presented to us along with a measure of delight." But what if you have spent, you know, the entire day working a terrible job, perhaps feeling humiliated, perhaps feeling small, and then you're asked to feel small again? Are you offering two different distinctions of feeling small, one that is beneficial and one that is harmful? I'm curious about this. You can unpack this.
There's being made to feel small by men, by other humans, and there's being made to feel small by something extra human, something non-human. And I think the two are fundamentally different, and one is helpful and one is not. And I think another word for the non-human way of feeling small is that word awe, A-W-E. And all the major faiths have moments where they make you feel awe before something that is larger, older, deeper, more profound, more mysterious than you are, than mankind is. And the idea is that before this larger force, the differences between you and others comes to seem less important, that the nature of your own struggles dissolves before something much, much more mighty. Now, we all of us get an echo of this. Well, if we're religious, we're likely to feel an echo of this, you know, in a cathedral, in a church, in front of certain prayers. If we're non-religious, we're likely to have felt that perhaps out in nature or in a planetarium or, you know, contemplating, I don't know, geological history. So these feelings are around, but I think that religions are particularly apt at using them and using them psychologically. You know, we've got planetariums, but often the implication of the planetarium is that you should go there in order that you might become a budding astronomer or join NASA when you're bigger. You know, it's for sort of for children to discover other planets. But I think what I'm more interested in is the use of science for psychological reasons, for psychological benefits, precisely for the creation of feelings of awe, which is a slightly different mission to using science as a scientist. Mm-hmm. It's an, if you like, an aesthetic use of science. And I'm intrigued by that and think that we could benefit from it because, you know, if you look at the big city around us, we're sitting in, you know, a rooftop hotel in New York City, and we are surrounded by the works of of men, of humans. And the awe that is produced is awe at the power and might of other human beings. And that can be humiliating, frightening, envy-inducing, ego-boosting, if you like. And it's very different. It's fundamentally different from being awed by a glacier,
yeah,
or the night sky or the wide open ocean. It is a very different category.
But when we're talking about someone like Proust and Tarkovsky, both of whom I'm crazy about, I mean, this is not exactly on the sort of mass level as, say, oh, I don't know, South Park or something, which also might be awe-inspiring in some sense. So the question is, I'm wondering if you have any ideas, not just from Proust, but also Tarkovsky and much of the art that you cite in this book. I mean, how do you get just the great mass of people behind something that, you know, everyone can agree on, like Tarkovsky is great? That's been an ongoing thing, because I know Jeff Dyer has a book and all this, but I'm wondering, you know, if that's a hard sell, some people think that what we might consider to be awe-inspiring is boring or slow. You know, what do you do to kind of get them on board?
Mm. Well, I think many things that are awe-inspiring are deeply exciting.
Yeah.
They're exciting to kids and they're exciting, yeah, to adults. If you look at some of the feed from the Hubble telescope, I mean, the images and the sequence from that is absolutely awe-inspiring and in no way boring. So I don't think we have to worry that it's going to be boring. Perhaps there's another point there, which is about art generally, which is a topic that I discuss in the book. And I'm struck by the way that religions are, on the whole, populist media. They operate at a high level, but also at a low level. That high-low division is kind of overcome by religions. If you think of religion in the Middle Ages, there would be, you know, the monks and priests writing in Latin, studying in their ivory towers. But there would also be, you know, woodcuts for the peasantry and plays in the marketplace. And so religion existed at many different levels. It tried to touch people at many different levels. And so it was a vulgarizing institution. I use, yeah, vulgar in a positive sense.
Yeah.
It aimed to diffuse knowledge and wisdom through in different media to different people with different expectations, etc. I think looking at the modern world, we do have a rather painful division between high culture and low culture. Yeah. The idea is high culture is good for you, serious, but a bit boring. And then there's low culture, which is not good for you, you know, a bit boring, a bit exciting, but you know, not profound. And that's painful. And I think in the greatest works of popular culture and high culture, you manage to find works which are everything, you know, which are hitting all the buttons. And so someone like Tarkovsky is almost a joke high culture figure,
yeah,
because he's so boring. In great things like, I don't know, Seinfeld,
yeah,
Curb Your Enthusiasm, right? These are works of genuine comic genius with deep psychological appreciation that are touching people at many different levels. And
well, to appreciate South Park, that. Are you a South Park fan?
I'm not so familiar with South Park, so I don't, yeah, know, but, you know, yeah.
Okay, you bring up superbia, the Augustinian notion of pride, which shuts us off from others. You point to such questions as, what do you do and where do your children go to school, as customary expressions of superbia. The questions you propose at the Agape restaurant, what do you regret, whom can you not forgive? This requires great faith. People aren't going to, again, answer these questions to just any old stranger. I'm wondering, what's so egotistical about getting a sense of a person through a few general questions? Isn't that where curiosity begins? I mean, getting to know someone?
I think what Christianity is interested in, and I'm, you know, as an atheist, interested in turn in this, is the notion that we can very easily use social status as a way of fending off other people and fending off our own vulnerability, that we can build walls around ourselves which will cut us off from important stuff. And frequently it's not until maybe someone's ill or goes through some kind of crisis or maybe has children that that they can get down off their pedestal and rediscover their humanity. And you know, you got to remember that Christianity was dealing with people from many different social classes, and it was quite a good analyst of the powerful. And its argument was, the powerful use earthly status and money to stop themselves recognizing their dependence on other people and on God. Now, as an atheist, I don't believe in the God bit, but I do believe this generally, the idea of dependence. You know, it's frequently not until the CEO has had his heart attack or has spent some time in hospital, or, you know, maybe their kid's been ill or something, that they're thrown back into the common run of humanity and realize what they have in common with everybody. And that can be a tremendously educative journey. And that's what a lot of Christian thought is about, and it intrigues me.
Late in the book, you point out that what makes religion so distinctive is that they have dared to assert coherent brand identities across a diverse range of areas, from the strictly intellectual and theological to the aesthetic, sartorial, and culinary. You then point out that we cannot be adequately marked by ideas unless they are echoed in what we wear, eat, sing, decorate our houses with, and bathe in. You also bring up role models, the possibility of action figures based off of thinkers, writers, and so forth. The question I have is whether this might actually fulfill the criteria of almost superbia, because if you're reducing a complicated and abstract feeling, say, our love for someone dear to us, or our concern for the CEO who has a heart attack, which you suggested before, you know, is this not the same as a marketing demographic? I mean, you know, why do we need to reduce something as complex and spontaneous as emotions to these kinds of expressions on a reductionist level? I'm curious about this. The brand identities thing is what I sort of was curious about.
I think what religions recognize is that when they're talking to people, you're not just talking to an intellect. You're not just talking to a rational person. That all of us are made up of bodies, senses, sensory stimuli. And that if you're trying to influence someone and touch someone in their life, you can't just write a book for them. If you're trying to have an influence, a real impact on life, books are not enough. You need to touch their whole beings. And that's why all religions get involved in stuff which in the secular world seems quite bizarre. You see, because on the one hand, religions are just a set of intellectual propositions. But on the other hand, they do funny stuff like make music, right? Why are they making music? Or they get involved in commissioning paintings, or getting us to eat together, or building buildings where, you know, the walls are painted in a certain way. Now, why are they doing this? They're doing this because they recognize that we respond to more than just reason. We're not just intellectual machines. We are also, we've got stomachs, we've got eyes, we've got ears, and you need to touch people through those senses. And that's why they've got involved in all sorts of things. They also recognize that one of the things that holds a body of ideas is a common identity. So that, let's say you're interested in forgiveness at an intellectual level, you might re-find that theme of forgiveness in a piece of music. And you may re-find that idea in a work of architecture. That an attitude that existed in a book might also exist in a kind of clothing. So what you're doing is uniting things that in the secular world are often very disparate, and you're trying to thread them together. And it's for that reason that religions have been leading proponents of what we would now call branding. Now, that we tend to think, oh, that means Nike, etc. But really what it means is the bringing together under a common project a whole host of things which might otherwise seem to be unique and isolated. And I think that's psychologically very true to the way we respond to things. We do respond in a very immediate way to things which seem united across media.
Yeah. What about like a place like Sao Paulo, Brazil, where they have actually eliminated advertising, and 70% of the people there say that this has had a very positive effect on their lives. Businesses, people have to actually talk with each other instead of being bombarded with what was styled visual pollution. I'm wondering if there's any sort of commonality between what religion can do and this sort of, I guess, uncluttered environment, or whether it's even a religious question. That's the other idea here.
Well, I think it's interesting that we tolerate advertising in a sense, because advertising plays on our confusion about what we need and what we desire. It's constantly stimulating us, and it takes a very rational, very strong person to resist advertising. And most of us don't. Most of us, at some point, quite regularly, buy stuff that we don't really need and doesn't make us happy or anything, because we've been lured. It's a trap. And yet we tolerate it for all kinds of complex political reasons, but not necessarily, you know, in the name of good things. Now, religions believe that we do need a version of advertising. They do advertise in the sense that their art is a form of advertising.
Yeah.
But arguably, it's advertising for something that's at least aims to be a little nobler than, you know, running shoes or a holiday in Thailand. That it's trying to make a public claim for certain states of the soul. So, look, in answer to your question, I think one option is to ban advertising. The other option is to make sure that among all the commercial messages that are out there, we're advertising not just things we don't need, but also some of the very important things we do need. And an advertising agency or moment that also remembered that, you know, qualities like love and forgiveness were important, you know, these too might be advertised. In other words, it's not just the commercial agenda. Anything that is important might be seen as something that we should think of advertising.
What about the Kony 2012 video that's been making the rounds? It's faced a lot of criticism. It's white privilege. Most of the money is not going to Uganda. It's going to marketing upon marketing upon marketing. And of course, many of the survivors of the LRA are basically saying, you know, the celebrities should be the children who actually survives. In this case, something that is a good intention goes awry. What is something like this?
Yeah, I think that's been executed badly. It's. I mean, really what that's trying to do is to use shame generated by society to shame a regime into change. I think it's very difficult to do it from one country to another. I think it'd be perfectly legitimate to use shame within a country and within a developed country that has social media, but for one country to do it to another seems very dodgy and very very difficult, which is why I think it hasn't quite worked.
I know you have to jam, and I have so many questions, but I have one last question. You tweeted the other day that the challenge for a human now is to be more interesting to another than his or her smartphone. I once spent 30 minutes on the subway just watching this young woman who was just absolutely addicted to her iPhone. She's sitting there, and it's like this narcotic, addictive glow. And when people tried to engage her, she could not. And this, to me, seems, yeah, I agree, it's one of the most pressing problems of our modern age. So, you know, what do we do to be more interesting than a smartphone, especially when it has that pull? How can we be more challenging? Well, I mean, do we go to religion? Do we go to various bits of Marvel or what?
I think we have to recognize that it's a problem, that it's an embarrassing problem. It is embarrassing because, I mean, when I tweeted that, it's almost a joke. It's kind of a joke. I mean, really, you're saying that the smartphone is more interesting than me? But the horrible truth is, yes, it may just be. So, number one, we've got to recognize it. We've got to talk about it. We've got to be honest about it. And then we have to recognize that it's not really true that other people, that the smartphones are more interesting than us. It's just we don't know how to be interesting to ourselves often. We don't know how to make that effort. We don't know how to tease ourselves out of ourselves. We, you know, it requires us to work a bit harder at doing that ordinary stuff of taking a proper interest in the person who's in front of you. And that's maybe an art that we're going to have to relearn. So, you know, the thing about technology is that it often forces us to relearn things we thought we knew, but we don't know anymore. And one of the things we need to relearn is silence, the value of silence, the value of being alone. You know, we thought we knew this, but we're having to relearn. So,
but look how a change, a technological instrument, over the matter of a few years has completely disrupted culture. I mean, and this is perhaps only an early iteration of what might come perhaps 10 years from now. So, you know, we have to come up with this, with a scenario for solitude is good, human communication is good, before this runs into a sort of technologically addicted age. I mean, I guess it comes back to my initial question. What do we do? Do we just have to be more interesting, more theatrical, more alive? I mean, you know, why can a piece of technology be more interesting than any complicated human being?
Mm. Look, it's the same phenomenon we have with advertising. We're easily excited by superficial things. It's just we have cognitive biases, which means that we can quite quickly get interested in things which are not that good for us. And we have to recognize that we have these biases and fight them a little bit harder than we have. It's like pornography. we are eating too much chocolate, whatever it is. You can quickly bypass people's rational best interests. And modern consumer society is really good at doing that. And so as informed citizens of these societies. We've got to get really good at bypassing these kind of cognitive lapses that commercial society constantly exploits and makes money out of.
Yeah. Well, Alain, I know you have to go, but thanks so much for taking out the time, and hopefully we can chat again.
Thank you so
Pleasure
much.
Pleasure to chat. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Dream that you were so cruel.